Hi everyone. Nice to see you all. As Rob said, this class is on the Buddhist perspectives on conflict and non-conflict. And this is a topic that to me has felt very alive in the last few years. Seems like there's a lot of conflict in our world, and that is kind of the emphasis that I'm looking at in this class is how conflict can be understood, how conflict between people can be understood from a Buddhist perspective, how we can see it in our own hearts and minds, understand how it comes up in relationship, and also to begin to look at what we can, how we can explore maybe coming to terms with conflict and also ways to navigate conflict, perhaps even to resolve conflict, although sometimes that doesn't feel like it's possible. So navigating conflict perhaps might be the goal, perhaps. How do we navigate our lives with all of this conflict? So let's start with a sitting to just settle in together. And I'll offer a little bit of reflection. One thing I'll say before we start the sitting, conflict, it's a form of dukkha. It's a form of stress, of suffering, and often we think of it as external to us. But we also can see internal conflict. We can see how our minds are fighting with themselves, and we can see how our minds fight with what's happening in the world. And so the exploration of our inner life can also be understood in a way as meeting conflict internally. And what does it mean to know conflict and non-conflict internally? And so in the sitting practice, we can explore how are we relating to stresses, how are we relating to reactivity that comes up as we're sitting. And the practice of mindfulness, the Buddhist practice of mindfulness, is really about understanding dukkha. That's what he said about the First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha, and conflict is a form of dukkha. Dukkha should be understood. And by understanding, what I understand he means by understanding is not thinking about, but meeting, understanding it experientially. And that is what the Satipatthana Sutta encourages. So, for instance, in the third foundation of mindfulness, the instructions say one should understand a mind of aversion as a mind of aversion, and a mind without aversion as a mind without aversion. One should understand a mind with greed as a mind with greed, and a mind without greed as a mind without greed. And so it's really pointing to understanding and knowing what our states of mind are, not judging them, not even trying to fix them consciously, not doing something about them. The Satipatthana Sutta mindfulness instructions are about understanding through meeting the experience. And what happens there, the follow-on from that, the follow-on from meeting our reactivity, our internal reactivity, from knowing aversion as aversion and knowing non-aversion, the non-arising of aversion, when the mind does not have aversion, as not having aversion. The mind begins to understand through that meeting that non-aversion is more spacious, more easeful, and we understand that the aversion or greed or any reactivity has a constricted quality to it. It's suffering. And the human system does not want to suffer. And the experience of meeting that reactivity is that it begins to let go. And so the process of this understanding of reactivity, understanding of dukkha, begins to create the conditions for dukkha to release. And so that's an important part of the Buddhist teachings on conflict, is that it needs to be understood. And through that understanding, there can begin to be ways for it to release, even not just internally, but also in the wider world. And so that's kind of a forward-looking kind of way to think about what we're going to be exploring in these 2 weeks. And so in mindfulness, exploring as we settle into mindfulness now, just settling in however you usually practice. Exploring the possibility of meeting what's here and just opening to it. And so we'll begin with a settling, however you typically settle. That may be as an open with an open awareness, just receiving whatever is arriving, whatever's arising. Or it may be settling with a primary object like the breath. And the mindfulness of whether we are practicing mindfulness in a focused way or in an open way, opening to what is being received. If we're receiving the breath, for instance, exploring the possibility of receiving it, letting it be as it is, allowing it to be as it is. We can be mindful of the breath as it is. We can be mindful of experience as it is. As we open to experience as it is, it can be useful from time to time to be curious about our relationship to the experience. Whether we're attuning to the breath or exploring open awareness or metta practice, whatever practice that you're doing, from time to time, kind of having a curiosity of how is the mind in relationship to what is happening? Is there a tension or a tightness around the meditation itself? Is there a liking or a not liking of what is arising? We can just kind of open and be curious. What is that relationship? You don't have to think about it or try to find it. We can almost just drop in a question. How am I in relationship to what's happening? And then just keep noticing what's happening, what's arising. Keep exploring experience as it is. Sometimes with that question dropped in, there can be a shift or a recognition. Oh, there's holding on here or pushing into or focusing or forcing or where there's confusion or frustration. And if we notice a relationship, we can just allow that also. That is an aspect of what is arising. Recognizing it as an experience, it's helpful to know that it's there. If it wasn't recognized before, it was kind of behind the scenes informing how we were practicing. And so just knowing it's there, you may recognize, well, there's frustration and there's this thing happening. That's what's happening right now. Sometimes as we notice a relationship, it shifts quite naturally. You may notice that we're holding on to the breath, for example, really tightly, and simply noticing that there can be more ease around being with the breath. And fundamentally keeping your practice simple, receiving experience as it is. Exploring the possibility of allowing. Even allowing those relationships when they're recognized. I like to end the sitting with a quote from a Zen teacher, Daishin Morgan. This reflection is around allowing, accepting. To accept means to receive what is offered. Circumstances of life give rise to conditions, and our acceptance of these conditions is just the acceptance of things as they are. What is not meant by the idea of acceptance is any agreement or disagreement with the way things are. Acceptance is about basing ourselves in reality, not about making judgments of liking or disliking or of agreeing and disagreeing. To accept the situation is to be grounded in the actual state of things, without getting lost in ideals or fantasies of how we would like it to be. We then have a good basis from which to see what action may be called for. Acceptance does not imply inertia. On the contrary, to be grounded in reality gives rise to a true response. So I like this quote. It really, to me, points to the importance of understanding as a ground for navigating conflict. That, and this, again, this is the way the whole of our practice is framed and unfolds, that we open to what is, and from that place, wisdom begins to arise and support us to navigate our lives. We make more skillful choices around how we engage in the world. We make more skillful choices around what happens in our internal lives. And likewise in the world, understanding the situation. Again, what I really love that this points to. Acceptance is about understanding what is already here, not turning away from it, not trying to, put a different veil on it and saying, well, if only this had happened, this is what would be here. We are fully, clearly acknowledging this is what is here. This is the state of the situation. This is the state of the world. Without inner conflict around that state of the world, that acceptance that this is the state of the world, this is what has come to be, as this quote points out, this gives us it creates the conditions for a skillful response to arise instead of our habitual reactivity coming from anger and hatred and confusion. And so this is, to me, this is a beautiful expression of, we could say, the overarching or an overarching perspective on conflict, from the Buddhist perspective. Conflict, as I said earlier, conflict is a form of dukkha. It's a form of suffering. When there is conflict, either internally or externally, we're feeling it. We're feeling the constriction. We're feeling the struggle. Other words for conflict in English: contention, resistance, fighting against, hanging on to, stress. Those are all words that evoke suffering, evoke dukkha. When there's conflict, we often feel like something has to give, something has to change. And perhaps there is, and we often think the other person needs to change to the way I am. And that's why we end up with the hard kind of fighting. And so the exploration of conflict is to begin to understand. And I think the first thing, what we'll be exploring this week really, is how conflict arises, how it arises in our own minds, and how it arises in the world. And largely the understanding in the Buddhist exploration is that conflict arises in each person's mind individually, and that that is where we end up kind of clashing. So there's a sutta. I did send out, I asked Rob to send out the sutta references. So some of you I hope you have copies of that. This first one, the exposition on non-conflict from the Majjhima Nikaya. A state with conflict is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. A state without conflict is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. Therefore, you shall train yourself thus. We shall know the state with conflict, and we shall know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. So there's some interesting things in this. I think this basically is pointing to conflict as a state of mind. That's what it's pointing to. It's a state of mind. It is arising in our minds. It's conditioned. All states in the mind are conditioned. It's an impermanent state. It is a phenomenon arising in the mind. The Buddhist understanding of mental phenomenon is that they arise in dependence on conditions and they pass away in dependence on conditions. They are impermanent. They are not self. They are simply phenomenon. They arise in dependence on conditions. And we will go into some of the conditions that create or that lead to the arising of conflict. And so the understanding conflict as a state, just understanding that it is conditioned, that's useful. And perhaps over the course of the class, we'll begin to understand why it's useful to understand it as a state. The Buddha also points out in the sutta that it's useful to understand the state without conflict. I think of this as very similar to what I mentioned about the third foundation of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta. One understands the mind with aversion and the mind without aversion. One understands the mind with greed and the mind without greed. Understanding that, one understands and feels that the mind without greed, the mind without aversion, the mind without delusion is a state of non-suffering. We feel the difference between when the mind is caught by aversion, caught by greed, caught by delusion, and when the mind is not. And the difference is palpable, feeling that difference. And feeling that difference, the understanding through the teachings of the practice of mindfulness, understanding that difference, the mind begins to move in the direction of non-suffering. It begins to let go of the tension, of the tightness, of the constriction around greed, aversion, and delusion. And so this is a similar pointing that one should train yourselves to know the state with conflict and know the state without conflict. And this can be conflict internally or conflict externally. So know in your own experience when there is that state or the mind that is fighting, that is hanging on to, fighting against, resisting. Know what that's like. And also know what it's like when the mind does not have that state. As we begin to recognize the difference between those two, it's quite natural that the mind wants to move in the direction of the state without conflict. Now, the one thing that's our minds are so confused. When the mind is in the state with conflict, and that holding, for instance, to aversion or anger, that mind, that the when that state is present in the mind, there's also often belief present in the mind that there's a belief that I'm right, and that if if I'm not following what I think is right here, there's no other way to end this conflict. For instance, with something like anger, when we experience anger, the mind caught by that anger or aversion is telling us the only way that I can get rid of this, the only way for this, like, to end, this anger to end, is to get rid of this thing that I don't like, to eliminate it in some way, or to get myself out of here. So in with aversion, the movement can either be a kind of lashing out or a pulling back. And the mind with aversion thinks those are the only two possible responses, that it somehow needs to get rid of the thing. It doesn't quite understand that there's other ways, other ways of taking action. The mind of aversion, the mind of conflict, believes that in the conflict, in the aversion, there's the answer to how to get rid of the conflict or how to get rid of the aversion. And that's a fundamental confusion, because that mind of aversion, when acted on, just generates more aversion. It may temporarily let us kind of be free from the thing, and then we get a moment of relief. But that pattern just tends to create the reliance on aversion, the reliance on, fighting, the reliance on that kind of conflict. And so this the quote from Daishin Morgan again points out there may be different ways to take action. We think that, the emotions that underlie conflict, greed, the aversion, those emotions that underlie conflict, when they're active, they think they're the only way to solve the conflict. But when we start to look at the conflict, look at those experiences, we begin to see actually there are other ways. There are other reasons why we would act. We can act out of wisdom and discernment, and we can act out of compassion. And those do not have to have aversion, anger, greed in them. And so that to me is what the Daishin Morgan quote is pointing to. To accept the situation is to be grounded in the actual state of things. We then have a good basis from which to see what action may be called for. Acceptance does not imply inertia. To be grounded in reality gives rise to a true response. And to me, that is what this quote from the Buddha, you should train yourselves thus. We shall know the state with conflict and the state without conflict. As we know those states, as we understand the difference between those states, the true response is moving in the direction of non-conflict. But it is not non-action. I think that's a crucial understanding. Non-conflict does not mean non-action. That's a hard thing for us to wrap our minds around sometimes. So I think that the teachings point us to understanding conflict. I mean, a lot of the mindfulness teachings are pointing to understanding internally what our experiences. But the Satipatthana Sutta also points to understanding experience internally and externally, and then both internally and externally. And so I think the application of understanding suffering can be not only about our internal suffering, but also the suffering in the world. How do we understand suffering externally? So I think that the approach, a lot of the approach will be to apply these teachings, some similar teachings around understanding suffering, how it comes to be, not only to our inner experience, but also to our outer experience. So a question can arise, how is conflict conditioned, constructed? And at this point, the turning more towards the relational conflict. How is relational conflict conditioned or constructed? The second sutta excerpt that is in the handout points to a question. Sakka is said to be one of the gods in one of the realms, and he came to the Buddha and asked him. And this is a question that has been repeated over and over again throughout the millennia. What binds us, gods, humans, all beings, what binds us so that they wish to be free of enmity, hostility, violence, and hate, and still have enmity, violence, hostility, and hate? I'm not going to read this whole thing. I'm going to just point to the chain of things the Buddha highlights here. So the Buddha responds, the fetters of jealousy and stinginess are what bind people to enmity, hate, violence, and hostility. This is a relational emotion. Jealousy, a relational emotion. We want something somebody else has. Stinginess, we want to keep what we have. This is kind of where the Buddha points to some of the foundation of relational hatred, relational, wars. Wars come out of stinginess and jealousy. Envy could also be added in there. Envy, the wish not only to have the thing that somebody else has, but to deprive them of having it. So that's kind of the basic relational thing the Buddha points to as to where conflict arises from. Jealousy and stinginess. So these are relational mind states. But again, they are mind states. They are conditioned. And so the next question is, so where do those come from? Where do jealousy and stinginess come from? And the Buddha responds, from the liked and the disliked. We like some things, we don't like other things. This is a pretty simple thing that we all understand and know, that we like some things and don't like other things. And from that comes, if somebody else has something we like or want and we don't have it, that jealousy arises because we like it, we want it. It's that process. Things we don't like, we don't want to have them. And Sakka is kind of has some wisdom because he keeps asking, so where does that come from? So this set of things he points to. So from the liked and dis so jealousy and stinginess arise from the liked and disliked. What is the source of the liked and the disliked? Desire is the source of the liked and disliked. What is the source of desire? And the word for desire in the Pali here is chanda, which is often just translated as desire, and it can be a kind of a neutral desire. It sometimes is prefaced or prefixed with dhammachanda, which is a wholesome desire, and it's sometimes prefixed with desires for things like kamachanda, the desire, sense desire, sense pleasure. And so in this context, it is mostly it is kind of connected to or associated with the kind of desire that's not helpful, the tanha, the craving, the wanting to hold on to the things that we like or the things that we like and we don't like. And here it says, what is the source of desire? And it says, thought is the source of desire. And that's an interesting pointing here. Again, everything that the Buddha is pointing to are conditions arising in the mind. Many of you may be familiar with the teaching on dependent origination, and I'll talk about that a little bit later too, in another way. But the teaching of dependent origination is a teaching that describes how suffering arises, so it's relevant in terms of exploring conflict as well. And in that teaching, it points to things that are pleasant and unpleasant as being the kind of the condition that leads to craving. So things pleasant or unpleasant. And it's often understood that seeing the pleasant and unpleasant, that that's a place where we don't have to launch into craving. It doesn't have to go there. And so that I think is an important piece, because what is it that launches us from pleasant or unpleasant into craving? Feeling itself, the feeling of whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, is understood not to be a, well, what do we call it? A decisive condition for the arising of craving. Because feeling pleasant, unpleasant can arise, and craving cannot arise. It does not have to arise when feeling happens. So when does it arise? At what point does that feeling lead to craving? When we're thinking about it. And when we're thinking about it from the perspective of, I need to have that. I want to have that. And so thought, what is the source of desire? Thought, what is the source of that craving? In some ways, it's more fundamental. And we could kind of look back in the chain of dependent origination and see that mental formations precede, in the chain of dependent origination, ignorance is at the head of the chain, and mental formations follow ignorance. And from the ignorance of the sense of me, the sense of needing to have, that shapes how we view things, how we look at things. It shapes what we take into consciousness. And what we understand as pleasant or unpleasant arises from that, and the desire also. And so the whole chain of dependent origination, before feeling leads to craving, there are already thoughts in the mind. There are already mind states in the mind. Already that view, that perspective, I need, I want, I have to have. So all of what the Buddha has pointed to, the jealousy, the stinginess, the liking and the not liking. And then, so thought is the source of desire. And what is the source of thought? Judgments driven by proliferation of perceptions are the source of thought. This is a proliferation is a translation of the word papancha. And there's another translation of this line from another person who translated the suttas. His translation of this is, the tendency to proliferation is the source of thoughts. So this is where the sutta then shifts to, okay, so how do we let go of the tendency of proliferation? That's the shift in the sutta. And you can look up the sutta and talk up and see how the Buddha pointed in that context of how to train the mind in the direction of non-proliferation. And it's basically the teaching is basically that we should understand when we're doing things, what things lead to conflict, what lead things lead to suffering, what things lead to not suffering, what leads to non-conflict. So it comes back to that, understand conflict, understand non-conflict. That the Buddha points back to, this is the training. understand conflict, understand non-conflict. There's several ways he approaches it. But I want to rather than going right to that, I want to look at a little bit more teaching on Papancha. Because this is a key. I think this is a key that the Buddha has traced, the teaching here has traced conflict in the world back to this tendency to Papancha. And what is Papancha? The tendency of Papancha is often translated as proliferation, often talked about in teachings around this topic as a lot of thinking. You know, this tendency to think a lot, the kind of a mind that's kind of run amok, just continually thinking, a mind lost in thought. Sometimes that is how Papancha is described. The teaching on Papancha, I believe, and from reading a number of descriptions of how Papancha, you know, is used and how it is described, several other teachers have pointed to it's a much deeper process than simply a lot of thinking. The key teaching on Papancha is in the suttas here, in the handout, which describes kind of how it arises. So dependent on sense experience, sense consciousness arises. It goes through it in terms of the six sense bases, but I'm just going to describe it in terms of sense experience in general. Based on sense experience, sense consciousness arises. With the contact of sense experience, there is feeling. And so it brings feeling in here. With what one feels, that one perceives. And so when we have a sense experience, and this is sense of seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and things happening in the mind. So the six sense bases. What one feels, that one perceives. So with the meeting of sense experience, there is a basic sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And when there's that kind of contact and the mind feels a contact with the sense base, there's a perception of it. We recognize what it is. It's a body sensation, it's a sight, it's a sound. We recognize it at that simple level. We may recognize it at a more complex level, like it's a bird or it's a car or a motorcycle, whatever. You know, we recognize the sound. That is a kind of a little bit in the direction of thinking, perception. It's kind of a shift from the feeling side of things to the more cognitive side, perception. And so it's very easy for that cognitive side of perception to shift into thinking. And that's what the sutta says. What one perceives, that one thinks about. When we perceive something, we start thinking about it. This is quite natural. We can see this happening in our meditation practice. We can see this happening in our daily lives. We're taking a walk down the road, and you know, a motorcycle goes by, and it's loud and it's noisy, and we hear the sound. We notice it's a motorcycle, and we start thinking about motorcycles. We start thinking about how people ride motorcycles and how much noise they make, and how frustrated we are with the amount of noise they make. And we've launched into thinking, and a little bit into Papancha. You know, that's kind of the traditional way Papancha is talked about. So what one thinks about that, what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. So that's Papancha. The next part of the sutta is kind of the key, because we don't simply think about things. We kind of hold on to that perspective, and then we start experiencing things from that perspective. So the way this is framed here, with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, so all of these thinkings about motorcycles and how, you know, frustrating they are, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, future, and present sense experience. And so that proliferation kind of creates a lens, we could say. It creates a perspective that then we start seeing experience through. So that perspective making, we could call Prapancha being perspective making. That's one way that our minds get really into trouble because we create a perspective, we create a perspective, we start meeting experience from that perspective, and we start believing that perspective. That's the area that I think is really the problematic nature of papancha. It's a very fundamental process in our minds that essentially one way to frame it is that we take our own experience to be the truth of what is actually happening. So this we could say is one form of papancha. We take our beliefs to be fact. We take our experience to be reality. What we are experiencing, this is a key understanding in the Buddhist psychology. Everything that we can only experience mediated through our own minds. We are not experiencing what is actually out there. What is arising, what we are experiencing is something that our minds have created. Every sight, every sound, every smell, every taste, every touch, every thought, every emotion is something created by our minds. We understand our mental stuff is often created by our minds, but our, sights and sounds and smells created by our minds, this is the understanding that we are experiencing mediated through our sense experience, the consciousness, the perception, the feeling, that is what we are experiencing. So we are not actually experiencing what's out there, but our process, the process of papancha, basically has us believing that what we are experiencing is what's actually out there. So our perspective is true, our views are true. This is a foundational process in our mind. And I think you can maybe begin to see how that view of I am right, my view is true, when replicated 8 billion times, everybody doing the same thing, right? It's not just about internal here, it's everybody has the same tendency to take their experience to be true, to believe their views to be how it should be. When we multiply that by 8 billion, of course there's conflict. Of course there's conflict. And so this is, I think this is kind of why the Buddha points back to that, the papancha as being the source of conflict. How basically it's coming back to views and attachment to views. I'm going to skip for now. I'm going to skip the views sutta. It basically is pointing to the familiarity that people basically believing my view is the right view, every other view is wrong. It also it includes the teaching that these views are created, again, realizing that how we believe, what our views are conditioned. They're conditioned. There's a place in the sutta, about halfway through, the Buddhist follower Anandapindaka is saying to these other folks who are all proclaiming their views and saying, my view is right. Anandapindaka says, these views are conditioned. They're arising either from their own inappropriate attention or from dependence on the word of another. So pointing again to the conditioned nature of views. Then when Anandapindaka expresses his own view, he expresses it in a different way. You know, he doesn't say my view alone is true, and it's not a view about it's Anandapindaka's view is a view about the nature of conditioned reality, not about something out there is the way it is. And that's a distinction between these types of views. So when Anandapindaka expresses his own view, he says, whatever is brought into being is fabricated, dependently arisen, and inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is suffering. Whatever is suffering is not me, not mine, not who I am. This is the sort of view I have. And so he's pointing to a view, a useful view, perhaps, you know, the followers kind of try to use his argument on back on him to say, well, you're just clinging to that view too. You're just, you know, this view, you're just holding on to that view. And it's also dependently arisen. And Anandapindaka says, yes, this is a dependently arisen view. And when I see that, I'm not clinging to it. I'm not holding to it. There's no suffering around that. So this is a pointing to a different way to hold views, and also to understand the kinds of views that are useful, because this kind of view, the kind of view Anandapindaka is pointing to, is a view that kind of undermines or is self-correcting, we could say. Gilfrandal Fronsdal often uses that phrase around the practice, that this view that things that are dependently arisen are suffering, and that's not me, not mine, not who I am. That the Anandapindaka says at the end, having seen this well, having seen the view, having seen a view with right discernment as it actually is, I discern the escape from it right now. I see it's possible to not cling to it. So this points to, you know, different kinds of views. The views the other people were expressing were views around the nature of this is the way it is. They were saying the cosmos is eternal, the cosmos is not eternal, this is how it is, this is how it is. Again, that kind of reifying or saying that what I have experienced or what somebody else has told me, that is the way it is. And the Buddha and the Anandapindaka says, this is my kind of view, this view that things are conditioned, and holding on to something conditioned is suffering. That kind of view helps one to not hold on to views. There is another sutta, the next sutta in the handout that points to the attachment to views as being a source of conflict. For one free of passion towards perception, there are no ties. For one realized through wisdom, there are no illusions. Those attached to perception and views roam the world offending people. So this is the pointing to, you know, the views, I understand views as kind of being, they're intimately connected to this process of papancha, the process of reifying, of taking what is out there to be actual experience, and the views that are created from that, the views that are created there. And then the clinging to views is a major source of conflict. As I said, you know, a few moments ago, if we multiply by 8 billion people saying, my view is the right way, the only way, everybody else's view is wrong, we will end up with wars. We'll end up with the state of the world. That's what we end up. So let's take a 5 minute break until 5 after the hour. All right. Well, before I open it to questions, I want to read another quote. This is from a scholar. He actually wrote a very relevant article, some of which I have used to create this presentation, this course. Professor Pali Hawadana and the article is called Theravada Perspectives on the Causation and the Resolution of Conflict, something like that. And it's available as a PDF file online. I will put that in the chat at a little later. Not right now, but I'll put that in the chat a little later. So here's what he said around this papancha. This process of distorted perception, of papancha, of placing every bare perception into a framework of emotions and beliefs that have come from our past, our history, our conditioning, robs the freshness out of our experiences. But we are not aware of this constant interference of the past. Because of this unawareness, which is our ignorance and our delusion, we see humanity fragmented into me and others, us and them, and in various other stereotypes, skin color, ethnicity, language, ideology included. And so this is pointing to another way that papancha works. It creates this sense of me and you, self and other, us and them, which is a huge place or realm in which conflict arises. And one thing I'd say too is like this conflict re related to selfing and othering. Sometimes the person in conflict who is experiencing the most suffering around the conflict is not the one who's clinging the most, who has the strongest identification. So people in a dominant culture, who are in a group and they are kind of sharing a perspective with others, if you're in the minority there, and it can be that the people who are in the dominant group are actually clinging more strongly to their perspective than the person who's suffering the most around, not having that perspective or being in a different, being the othered, being the other, being othered. So people in the dominant culture can cling strongly to views of culture and are often unaware of that clinging because it is the dominant view. And not agreeing with those views can be dangerous, as we're kind of seeing play out here. All right, so some questions. And Barton.
Hi. Hi, Andrea. So just a maybe a quick one. You a little while ago, maybe 20 minutes ago or so, I should say, by the way, speaking of conflict, I'm somewhat conflicted today. I accidentally signed up for two courses, and I don't know, I got the dates mixed up. I don't think it's fair to the teachers to tell you which one I went to. But anyways, I'm glad I came to this. So what I wanted to know, you were talking earlier about how the mind, everything originates in the mind. And this is a principal teaching, I believe. It's highly relevant for me lately because I've been contemplating and meditating on and studying emptiness, which is a concept that I sort of grasp, but don't really grok or get completely yet. I don't quite feel it in my bones, sort of thing. I'm still thinking it through because it's fundamentally opposed to everything that we experience in our lives and are taught and, so forth, and that we tell ourselves. So when you were talking about, for example, when you perceive a thing, it's not as it is. I can't remember your exact words, but is that what you were referring to is emptiness basically in the perceived thing?
I would say that, yeah, I mean the nature of our experience is constructed. It is not, I mean, and so what we experience of something, it's just little, like what we see is actually like little pixelated things. And when I see a picture on the wall, it's actually, actually constructed in the mind. And we can actually see the reflection of it on the retina. You can see how it's being created in the sense space, and then in the mind that we then interpret it as a picture. And so what we're experiencing is not the actual thing. It is something that is created, and that creation is, it's just a creation. It's not a thing. And so that it's empty in that way. And in the Buddhist understanding, the Theravada perspective, the perspective of the suttas is that emptiness is empty of self and what belongs to self. And so the understanding of emptiness from the Theravada perspective is that whatever we, whenever we take something to be I, me, or mine, we are reifying. And that's that process of papancha again. We're kind of saying this is a thing. And it's not what we take it to be. It is processes unfolding. There's no thing here. It is empty of any inherent existence, essentially, what
That's where it gets confusing because to say that a thing is empty is not the same as saying that it doesn't exist. And I've tried to explain this to a couple of people. I'm still working on, like, as I say, really deeply understanding it and accepting it. There's a difference between the intellectual grasping of a concept and then really taking it to heart and embracing it in all things, I guess, in my life. So when I try to explain to others, I'm still failing a bit, but the biggest thing that comes up is everybody says, "So you're saying it doesn't exist?" Like, no, that's not what I'm saying. And it's so anyway, thank
sometimes
you.
what I
It's
say is it doesn't exist in the way we think it exists.
well, it's I think what you just said is really good. You were saying, we are basically reifying that thing, recreating it, whatever you want to call it, as a representation in through our sense doors. We're taking it in, then we reify it in our mind to kind of reconstruct it or whatever you want to call it, but it's so that we can process and hold the thing that is not actually in our mind as a construct or as a virtualization or whatever you want to use as terminology. So for example, I can look at an image of an airplane and I don't have to be next to the airplane. So there's actually a double representation. There's the photo, and now I'm reifying the photo and I'm thinking, oh, how cool is that airplane? And, I haven't actually been next to the airplane. So anyway, thank you. This is helpful. I might come back to this later. We'll see where we go. So I do have to say that this question, there's the other thing I'm just going to mention quickly, this question about conflict. I hope you're going to touch on compassion later. You were talking about how there is so much conflict because people see things so differently, the 8 billion people and or the infinite representations of 8 billion people. And yet I personally feel that I'm taking up a lot of time, but I personally feel that there is no immediate fix for that, other than you talked about Gil Fronsdale a little bit. He's doing this Anicca course right now, which is basically about compassion, how fundamental it is to all of these issues in terms of finding ourselves a bit of an option for making things better. So anyway, I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Mostly I'll talk about compassion next time. This time is more looking at how it comes up. How does conflict
Yeah.
arise? How does conflict arise? That's mostly what this week is about.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Beverly.
Yeah, so you've been talking a lot about Papanchka, Papanchka, and how that relates to views. And I get it. I've noticed it in my experience a lot. Like I'm surrounded by men at work, right? And someone says something to me, and then my first instinct before thinking is just to take it at face value. And then I notice something grates, and then wheels turn. And then I think, you know, maybe it's because I'm a woman that he said that. Or there's some kind of ulterior motive, or it's because it was, but it's always after the wheels turn. And often it's not the case, right? It's just filtered through all my long experience. Like I grew up surrounded by men in my field when people were much more sexist than they are now. And so it's my conditioned experience. But some views are from, not developed from that, right? They're from wisdom and discernment. And I suspect that if you talk to anyone with a view, clinging to it or not, they would say, no, that view is from my superior wisdom and discernment. So yeah, they're not going to listen to your Papanka argument. And how do we tell the difference, right? Where, what frame of reference do we have now for what kind of views we have and what are valid and what are not?
that is one of the things about views is like, no, my view is right, you know. And so how do we tell the difference? I mean, again, it's kind of like that's the story with Ananda Pindika. You know, what kind of views actually can be more onward leading? So Ananda Pindika's view that views create suffering, you know, clinging to views creates suffering, is a different perspective of view. And so that, you know, I think in terms of like the kind of views around, well, should we program the computer this way or this way? I think that, you know, probably, you know, not so, you know, we could just have the discussion about, okay, well, these are the benefits, these are the pros and cons of each one, and
right.
Et cetera.
Yeah, there's an easy way out of those ones, yeah.
Yeah. So it's more the ones around, you know, who deserves to live and who deserves to die and that kind of thing that I think we need to look at the you know what the clinging is there. So the clinging to it is an important piece. If we can not cling to our view, then we have a better way of understanding, is this a useful view or is it not a useful view? So I think that's the first piece is looking at the clinging to the view. And so many people, it's like, no, this is right. You know, I know this is right. It's like, I think we have to have the, and this again, more around navigating conflict, but we have to be willing to set that to the side for a moment and be willing to listen to other perspectives and not hold tightly to our view to see, you know, is, well, let's look, let's see, are there other views that might be useful here?
Right. So I live in an asymmetry at work, and the people around me seem much more wanting to cling to their views, and I seem to be the only one that finally gives in.
Well, and that's another issue. I mean, it's like, why do I always, you know, why do I always have to be the one?
Yeah, right.
You know, so I mean, that is part of living in a world where there are, you know, most people are not looking at their views. Most people are not looking at it. That, again, talking about navigating conflict next week, we'll go into some of what we can explore there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mariana. And this will be the last one, and I see if there's something in the chat.
Well, this doesn't relate, I guess, directly to what you've been talking about, but I guess it kind of relates to this idea that we'll always have conflict because of there being 8 million people or billion people perceiving things differently. Obviously, at Buddhist time, there weren't 8 billion people, although there were perhaps 8 billion beings. But I've been listening to someone who talks a lot about cults, and particularly in the relation to the United States, although obviously it's not specific to that. And she talks about having grown up in a cult and how you're taught in a cult not really to trust your own perceptions. That you're told, now, if you're seeing it this way, that's not valid. And if someone is telling you that that is valid, you are listening to the devil or whatever, or someone who wants to do you harm, and it's often used as an excuse to justify a lot of stuff. But then when someone's in a cult, if you don't understand that that's the perspective they're coming at from, the way they talk doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of wondering in terms of the balance between like letting go of the belief that what you're seeing is necessarily true versus a very common pressure in society, and I don't think it's just cults, to be telling its members, no, if you see it as different, you're wrong.
Yeah, this points to actually the next piece that I was going to talk about, so I can just say some of that. Now is how do views arise? How do views come to be? in the teaching. The Ditti Sutta, the View Sutta, Ananda Pindaka says, your views arise either based on your own inappropriate attention, that is, attending to your experience in a way that is not accurate, or based on the words of another. And so these are two of the main ways that views arise. They're shaped by our own experience. Our personal or meditative experience, they're shaped by our views, our ideas, our prior views and ideas, our mental formations, and they're shaped by the views of others. So the story of the blind people and the elephant is one of the stories that talks about views being created. So that's also in the That's in the handout. And basically, I'll just summarize again. A king said to one of his people, bring an elephant and find all the blind people in the kingdom and bring them here. And the king is wanting to make a point around perspectives. And so the king asked the person to show the blind people the elephant. And there's two pieces going on here that I think are interesting to see. So to some of the blind people, he presented the head of the elephant, saying, "This is the elephant." To some of them, he presented the ear of the elephant, saying, "This is the elephant." To some, he presented the tusk, the trunk, the body, the foot. The tail, the tuft at the end of the tail, saying, "This is the elephant." And then the king said, "So have you shown the people the elephant?" And he says, "Yes." And they said, "Well, okay, now tell me what an elephant is like." Those who had been shown the ear of the elephant replied, "An elephant is like a winnowing basket." Those who'd been shown the body, "An elephant is like a storeroom," and so on for each one. Saying the elephant is like a different thing. And the story goes on that saying an elephant like this is like this, an elephant is not like that. They fought each other with their fists. So the view around what an elephant is was constructed on two pieces. It was based on their own experience of the elephant. And it was based on the person showing them the elephant saying, "This is an elephant." So now they could have perhaps, in this case, it's not wrong to say that an elephant is like a post, that this part of the elephant is like a post, or this part of the elephant is like the wall of a storeroom. But they were told this is an elephant, right? This is what an elephant is. And so the perspective that they that this is kind of like the apocryphal story around how views are created. They were told that that was an elephant. Their own experience is what they are going on. And then when other people say it's something else, they're going, well, you're wrong. They're not conceiving that there may be a larger picture. So I think this is another important piece around views, is that maybe there's a larger picture that can hold multiple perspectives. So that's an important part of the teaching. But also I'd say that it's important to recognize, how views are created. And so this is one way that, you're kind of, it's a combination of somebody telling you something and your direct experience. Views also arise based on what other people say. This is a key, and this is what Mariana was pointing to, I think, is views arise in dependence on the people that we're around. This is the teaching, what one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. That famous excerpt, it's kind of like what we're frequently exposed to becomes how we see the world, essentially. So how do our views get constructed? I think this is an important piece to recognize. Again, views are conditioned, and recognizing how they are conditioned, how they come to be, it's not simply through our own mental processes that views come to be. So that's one way that views come to be, through, reifying that what we're taking to be, what's out in the world, we're taking that to be reality. That's that kind of, this is what I'm experiencing, so this is what's true. That's that part of how views are created. But we are also in the company of people who have been shaping views. And when we are young, often we're in the company of parents, et cetera, people who are older than us, whose views have been shaped over the course of their lives. And they are sharing their perspective of the world with us through language, through how they engage with the world. It's not just through speech, but it's also through how they interact. They are shaping our perception of the world because we're in the field of what they believe. So this, to me, this is a pointing to a way that dependent origination works. I mean, the dependent, again, we often think of dependent origination as being within one mind, how does suffering arise? But so the dependent origination excerpt is at the end there. And so the last page, it lists the set of conditions. With ignorance as condition, volitional activities come to be. With volitional or mental formations, with mental formations as condition, consciousness. With consciousness as condition, name and form, the sixfold sense bases, then contact, feeling, craving, grasping, being, birth, aging, and death. So it's that kind of that chain. The place that I think is very interesting is the So with ignorance as condition, mental formations come to be. Ignorance is present in our world. Ignorance is present in our own minds. The tendency towards believing our experience to be reality, it's kind of in our human sense experience. It's kind of in there as like that our minds will stabilize the world. And we can walk across the room and not run into things. And it's like, well, yeah, that lamp is really there, and that couch is really there. I mean, it's like the nature of our sense perception contributes to these belief the believing that what we're experiencing is reality. And so that's part of the human process. But a lot of our mental formations and our ignorance is, let's say, absorbed from our environment, from the people that we're around, from what we take in what we choose to read, what we choose to expose ourselves to. And so, as Mariana was pointing out with something like a cult, these views are kind of repeatedly brought in. And you're taught in that kind of a cult to distrust your own experience, to distrust your own experience. But this tendency to have our views shaped by the views of others. So I look at like the dependent origination as being not simply a cycle within our own minds, but it's kind of like, you know, the cycles that we go through in our own mind, they're informed by the mental formations of others. They're shaped by the views of others. And so our own views are shaped by our external environment. And what we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. So this kind of, I think of dependent origination as being kind of a back and forth conditioning, that we are shaped by our environment. We are shaped by what other people are saying and doing and believing. And others are shaped by what we are saying and doing and believing. So it's an interactive process. I think of the dependent origination as kind of, we all meet at mental formations, ignorance and mental formations. We're all meeting there in a sense that we're influencing each other. And we know this, you know, we know that our mental formations are contagious in a way that when we are angry or when we're in the presence of someone who's angry at us, what often happens is that anger arises here. So that is very, very kind of common, the sense of this back and forth shaping of the conditioning. And we can feel it. We know it happens. We've experienced it happening. So I think with that's a kind of a long answer in a way to Mariana's question around, you know, like knowing that this is a part of what happens. It's important to understand this, that we are shaped by our environment, that others are shaped by their environment. And I think what you said, Mariana, again, is like not understanding the perspective of somebody else. You know, what they say doesn't make any sense. But if you can kind of see that they've been shaped by that conditioning, shaped by that perspective, then there's perhaps a little more understanding. And compassion does arise with understanding. That's a kind of a natural response. When we understand suffering, compassion is a more natural response. And so that when we see how we've been shaped by our conditioning and others have been shaped by our conditioning, there can be more of a sense of compassion, of not only for ourselves, but for others. I think that, so understanding that these are processes at work in our own mind, when we can see, and this to me is where it really began, is beginning to see in my own experience how when I was angry at somebody, I wanted them to suffer. You know, it was a shameful thing to see. You know, I did not like seeing that. It's like, it felt like, oh, is that really in here? That I want that person to be in pain? And it was there, that conditioning, you know, that was arising when anger arose with me, in me, I wanted the other person to suffer. And to me, there was not only the seeing of that, but it also was a kind of a feeling of great compassion because I could see in that moment, this is not just happening to me. You know, this is multiplied by 8 billion. You know, this of no wonder there's so much suffering in the world. If this mind, you know, wants another being to suffer when I'm angry, no wonder there's so much suffering in the world. And so the seeing of how our own minds are shaped and conditioned and driven around by the forces of greed, aversion, and delusion. It's really useful to understand that it's happening here, but also that it's happening in everyone's mind. That can help us to maybe begin to see again, how maybe can we start to navigate this by beginning to understand the perspectives of others. And so this is an investigation, and this is kind of a little pointing to next week. Conflict is a great source of learning for us. You know, when there is conflict, it can point to ways that we're obviously clinging. ways that we're, holding on to something. It also might point to ways, that again, the selfing and othering, it might point to ways that when there's conflict and we think it's the other person's problem, that it's not me. Clearly, if you thought the way I did, everything would be okay. So if the other person, if we feel like it's the other person, we can begin to start to see the us and them, and maybe something about understanding their perspective, and perhaps recognizing that we're clinging to our own view, and maybe there's something broader that we can begin to learn with investigation of the conflict. So I think this again points back to what the first teaching said. Conflict is a state. It's conditioned, it's impermanent, it's not self, and it's not other. It's not their doing. It's not our doing. It is conditioned on the kind of the interface. It's the self, other, and both. It's conditioned on that interface. And so what is the conflict? When there's conflict, it can point to our own clinging, it can point to delusion, it can point to hidden clinging, clinging that we haven't clearly seen, something that we think, well, obviously my view is right, my perspective is right. I've lived with this perspective all my life, and nobody else has challenged it. So, why should I take this person's perspective? Perhaps you've just been in a little bubble, so maybe there's something to learn from another perspective. And so this, again, the understanding conflict is kind of the, knowing that it is a process, knowing that it is arising. The Buddha pointed to understanding suffering. This is our basic first foundational approach with suffering. Understand the suffering. And so how do we begin to understand the conflict, the external? How do we begin to understand the external? A lot of this is in the realm of dialogue, in the realm of speaking. Speech has a big role to play in the navigation of conflict. And we'll talk a lot more about that next week, but I want to close up this part of the section and then again open it up to comments, questions, reflections. We could consider dialogue, a true dialogue, a dialogue where we're interested in understanding what the other person has to say. Here's a definition of dialogue that I like. Dialogue has a unique aim. Rather than trying to convince or proselytize or resolve a conflict, the primary goal of dialogue is to understand more deeply other perspectives. Rather than being opponents who seek to expose the weakness in each other's arguments, dialogue's participants engage in a conversation that starts with the assumption that the other has something to say to us and to contribute to our understanding. Thomas Schwant says the initial task is to grasp the other's position in the strongest possible light. This is a form of mindful investigation, of curiosity, of, okay, let's see if I can understand what's happening in someone else's mind. Let me see if I can understand their perspective. This is kind of the foundation, even before we look for resolution of a conflict. The kind of understanding the perspectives at play in the conflict is where we begin. This is kind of one of the contributions, I think, that the Buddhist perspective brings to conflict, that we need to understand the conflict before we start trying to resolve it. And that's again coming back to what Daishin Morgan said, that quote that I brought in. Acceptance does not apply inertia. To be grounded in reality, and that is just to say, okay, what is here? The conflict is here. What is the experience? What is happening? How is that conflict coming together? What are the views that are participating in the conflict? Views being a huge piece of needing to understand. What are the perspectives, the filters, the views that I'm looking through? What are the perspectives, understanding what the perspectives that somebody else is looking through? That's the ground. That's where we begin. So can we be curious? Can we bring a curiosity? And this is I teach about in looking at our own experience. I talk about curiosity a lot. It's like, be curious about what's happening in your experience. Like, what is this experience as a human experience? That curiosity is the ground from which understanding grows. And in the external, the internal and the external, that dialogue is a way towards that understanding. And we don't, again, it doesn't have to be about accepting the other person's perspective. It's about understanding, not accepting, not agreeing with or disagreeing with, but understanding what is the perspective that the other person is holding? What is the perspective that I am holding? Because that's an important part of the conflict too, to see that the how I'm engaging is from a view also. Maybe we're not seeing the whole elephant. Maybe I'm not seeing the whole elephant. Maybe the other person has a piece of the elephant to contribute to the conversation. So I got kind of engaged there. So what are your reflections here? We have some time for comments, reflections. Yeah, Mary.
Hi there, this is so helpful. I don't think you're going to have a definitive answer to this, and it's not well formed in my mind, so I may not present it very clearly. But I just spend a lot of time with a son who is contemplating a divorce and heading towards a new relationship. And as you were describing views in Papancha, I just, in my mind, I was just seeing very clearly, much more clearly than I have before, his suffering and the suffering of his wife. They have a 9-month-old daughter. Anyhow, how do we help? And that you may get into this next week. Is there any benefit in sharing this and talking about it with our loved ones when we see how stuck they are and kind of where they're stuck? I mean, that's another view in my mind. That's my perspective. And so, is there any sense in saying this is what I'm seeing going on, especially when they're very defensive and very angry and caught up in I'm right, and this is what I need to do, and causing unbelievable suffering all around. Anyhow.
Yeah, I mean the time to speak to somebody. So it sounds like you're not in the middle of this conflict, right? You're kind of seeing it and seeing, wow, there's a lot of suffering happening there.
And I
And
can place myself in the middle, which just makes much more of a mess of it. Not a
right. And possibly, it's a delicate thing to say, this is what I'm seeing. If you can frame it in a way that, like, again, this is my perspective. This is how I see it. I don't know that it's right. I'm not, it might also be that that would be one way to, if you think they could hear it, we'll get into speech more next week, and that kind of question of what is the right time to speak? It is not the right time to speak when somebody is not going to hear it, or is going. It's because often when there's a conflict, if we bring a view that is counter to somebody else's view, one of the patterns there is it actually entrenches them more in their view, and so you need to take care with that. But another thing you could explore is just sitting down and saying, "I'm willing to be an ear." Tell me what you're experiencing. Tell me what's happening for you. I want to know. I want to understand. You're my son. I want to understand how you are. And that process, sometimes if you can enter into a process of dialogue and wanting to understand what's going on, they see something new and they shift their, so I've seen this happen before, like they shift their entrenchment into curiosity. And so that might be an approach, to not go in with your view, but go in wanting to understand their views.
Yeah. I think it's a very interesting place to see how the suffering of one we're very close to is impacting us and how much, especially mother child, we want it to stop because it makes us suffer as well. So I can, there's so many layers in this that get touched upon that it's really something. It's like entanglement.
Well, absolutely. And I think we pointed to something very important. It's like when we are wanting to, you know, step in and resolve a conflict that maybe it's not our conflict, but just like step in. It's like, what's the motivation? You know, is it because I'm suffering? I don't want to see this anymore. Is that the motivation? Maybe I need to enter from another motivation. And we can have mixed motivations, you know, so yeah. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't take some action. It just means it's helpful to know clearly, again, understand what's happening in your own mind, what your own views are, understand that they are conditioned. And what is it conditioned on? Oh, it's conditioned on my own suffering. Okay, right. Yeah, it's really important. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Kate.
Well, when you got worked up, you definitely got me on that part. So I'm speaking a lot to reaffirm for myself, because a conflict that I get into with my partner, I really don't want to hear his side of it. And boy, I'm really understanding how dangerous that is and wrong that is. And the way you explained it, it was like, oh my God, I really need to just, even if I still don't agree, even if I still think that his view is creating suffering for him, I still need to really hear him and try it on. And I know there are little aspects of it that I could go yes to, but damn it, I don't want to. Sort of thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad if there can be any interest in like broadening the perspective. It's like, oh, I see my side of it is I don't want to understand them. You know, that's a big place of where the suffering happens. You know, again, I love that quote by Dyson Morgan, because it really points to, it's not about agreeing or disagreeing. It's about looking at what's here. And in conflict, it's about looking at what's here and what's external also, and really understanding it, as the quote for dialogue, to grasp the other's position in the strongest possible light. And once that is there, then there may be some place to look at resolution of conflict. You know, so to, yeah.
And is that quote, the one about understanding the other person's side, is that in our notes? I'm not looking at them.
Posted
or something?
Yeah, I think I'll include it in next week's post. Okay. That's a good thing. And I'll include the Dyson Morgan quote in that too.
Great.
And I'll put both of those in next week's handout. Yeah, thanks. Vicki.
It's been a long time since I've seen you, so it's really nice to be back and you're with as you as a teacher here. I just want to say I'm in the Washington DC area, so there's a lot of conflict around, and I can't help but I keep thinking about seeing our president on TV yesterday with a hat that said Trump was right about everything, in the context of what you're talking about, clinging to views. And I am so triggered by that kind of thinking and the destructiveness. So it's not interpersonal. There's a lot of, just really being set off by this kind of thinking that's so one-dimensional, and so I'm feeling that it's triggering my one-dimensional thinking as well, as you've pointed out.
But in that kind of a situation, you know, that is what we can look at. We cannot change. I mean, it's like we don't have a relationship with that, with that person necessarily. I mean, this is not an uncommon thing where, it's that somebody is very strongly clinging to views and not really seeing that or not aware of it, and it's creating suffering for people around them. How do we engage with that? And again, I'll talk more about some of that next week. But some of our work is seeing where we're triggered, because responding or acting, we can act in certain ways. We can go to protests or write op-ed letters or whatever. We can do things like that. And it's from the perspective of our practice and from the perspective of what's skillful, doing that, not from being triggered ourselves, so that's our work first.
Okay. Yeah.
How can we hold that without being triggered ourselves? So looking at what that how that triggering is working. It's like, well, I wouldn't be triggered if he didn't hold to cling to his views. Well, when is that ever going to happen, that there's not going to be somebody
Okay.
in the world strongly clinging to their views? And so, we're not going to ever eliminate all of the world's, beings that cling to their views. And so what might we be able to, how might we be able to not be triggered by that? And so that's an exploration for ourselves. And that's a kind of more internal exploration to begin to see what is it touching? What is it touching? Because often it touches things that are old and deep. It's touching childhood conditioning. It's touching not being seen. It's touching, a lot of vulnerability. It's touching a lot there. It's touching fear. It's touching, so it is possible to be able to see all of that and understand kind of that's how and what is arising here, and recognize, it's probably not going to completely go away. It's like before we take action. So there's going to be mixed motivations. There's going to be that perspective of they shouldn't be that way, and a little bit more understanding of our own clinging there. And if we can, and this comes back to the compassion side, if we often seeing the suffering that others are, that kind of view creates, not just for ourselves, but for others, we want that a part of us wants to alleviate that suffering. And that's a wholesome wish. The wish of compassion is a wholesome wish. And so when there is mixed motivation, when there's that, I just want to get rid of that person, and and I want the suffering to stop. Can there be more of a connection to the compassion side of it than the aversion, the anger side of it? Because we are going to have mixed motivation over our.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. All kinds of ideas came about what just triggers, so that there's a lot of fertile ground there for me. And just one other thought, I know other people want to speak, but just thank you for this expanded view of Papancha, because I think the way I learned Papancha was, monkey mind and the monkeys going from one branch to another. So I always just thought of it as the activity of the mind, how quickly it moves and moves back. But this, to put it in the sort of proliferation and then what happens with proliferation. So thank you. Thank you for that. Very
Yeah,
helpful.
you're welcome. I found that also very helpful to understand it. And there are places in the suttas where the absence of a papancha is very close to freedom and enlightenment. And we know that the absence of thought is not, I mean, that's not close to freedom. That can just be concentration. So so there's something more there. There's definitely something more there.
If there are more suttas, because you mentioned the Honeyball Sutta in relation to this one, but if there are more, I'd be interested to know which ones to look up.
I think for the exploration of Papancha in these lines, I've gotten from a couple of different books that pull things together. One, Concept and Reality in Buddhist Thought. I'll put that reference in the, I think it's Nyanananda, Jnanatiloka, Nyanananda, I can't remember. I'll find that and put that in there. And then Tanisiro Bhikkhu's writings on Papancha also have been very useful to me.
Okay.
So, and those will point to some of the other references.
Thank
Yeah.
you. Thank you.
All right, we have a few more minutes. I see there's a couple things in the chat. Okay, one of them was from you, Vicky, and one is from Barton. So Barton, I see you're next, and that this will probably be the oh, actually, Barton, if we could hold off because you did share earlier, so I'd like to shift to Dave, and I'll see if I can respond to your question next time. So Dave.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm a mathematician, and it's I do come into this with a lot of concern. Well, as this woman just alluded to about what's happening in Washington, but it occurred to me too that there's some conflict in my areas that's really quite cool. In mathematics, you're just having a very boring, unsatisfying career if you don't enjoy the conflict that comes up in new thoughts. When I come up with a theorem and someone says, "No, that's wrong," that's kind of a hoot. I realize now I've got someone who's thought about it, who's really put work into understanding what I'm trying to do, and we end up becoming fast friends. I have some of my best friends. I'm one fellow I know from mathematician from Harvard who said he was just so stunned when I told him one of his theorems was wrong, and we just become best buddies for the last 30 years because I proved something wrong. It's exhilarating. So it's sometimes conflict, the disagreements can be, we can learn so much from them, and we make so much progress in science and in mathematics precisely because of the conflict. And those have got, and people who aren't enjoying it are having, they're not having very much fun in their career, and it becomes staid, just dead in the water. That's it. So thank
Yeah, I
you.
mean, I think is an important piece. Can we look at conflict? I mean, conflict in these kind of situations, it feels less personal in some way. Although, as a mathematician, proving a theorem is like, oh, I figured something out. Having somebody say you're wrong might be a little bit of a, if you're holding tightly to I did that, that would create conflict internally. But if it can be like, oh, there's another perspective, let me see, let me learn, if we're looking at conflict as a place of learning, I think that is a really great approach. And I think that's what I was saying toward the end, is like conflict is a place where we can learn, and if we can have it as that approach, what am I missing about myself? How am I, what did I not see here? What did I not know? What did I not understand? Because that there's again, it's like the elephant. It's like there's something else. There's something else. There's a bigger picture that I don't know. And so I love that perspective of, having fun with conflict. I mean, it's some kinds of conflict maybe we can't have fun with because they're leading to war, but to still have the same approach, there's something to learn here, I think it's a useful one. Yeah, thank you for that comment. Yeah. And yeah, Barton, there's 2 minutes if you can say something in 2 minutes that.
I think it's easier if you can read what I posted to
Okay,
the
yeah,
chat.
well,
That's basically my question, and we might have to park it for next time.
okay, let's see. Frequently, people cling to their views and behavior towards others because of fear. What they found is that helps them to cope is what they will cling to. So it's frequently difficult to find balance and avoid conflict with that sort of person. They're so entrenched in that position. How can we, with the goal of preventing or ending conflict, address this issue? So yeah, I think it is more towards next week. And again, it's again looking at where somebody else is entrenched in their position. What can we do there? And some of what I responded to with Vicky, I think. I don't remember who it was, but yeah, that kind of like the looking at somebody else holding tightly to a position. How do I navigate that? And then, as I responded to the person who was the parent, it's like maybe asking them questions about their view, their perspective, you know, help begin to understand what they are clinging to. You know, that again, that dialogue, that trying to understand, sometimes that does help people to see their own perspective. You know, if you're saying you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, it tends to entrench the perspective. If you're saying, what do you think? How does that work? How does that work? Tell me about that part. Tell me about that part. They may begin to see something that they did not see before also. So
I think what I'll have to do is explain it a bit more, because like several other people, I have practical concerns that I want to try to address, as well as just, you know, coming to better understanding of the concept. So I'll come back to it next week. Maybe I can I email the question or something in advance, or should I just ask it again?
I think asking it again would be easiest, because I don't have a way, unless
that's fine. Yeah, I can do that. All right, well, I won't take up more time. Thanks, Andrea. We'll see you soon. Have
okay,
a good week.
Thanks, everyone. And it's time to stop. So I hope that this has you, I mean, that this part of the conversation has you at least interested in investigating, being curious about conflict as a way that we can learn about ourselves and others. So, yeah. And see you next time, I hope. Bye, everyone.